favorite color today is Carl's Honor. Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2016. Senator Costello, the VP, is Vice Chair Senator Diesel, and Senate President Joe Meyer, and Senator Johnny Ellis. Welcome. The time is 1:32. And before we get started today, we have one bill on the agenda. We'll first go to public testimony, and then we'll probably recess while we're waiting for our community substitute to arrive hot off the press, and then we will take a look at that, incorporate some of suggestions that we heard of from the previous meeting. But this meeting is the last meeting of the week, and so I just want to mention that we are in the Belts Committee Room, stands in honor of William Belts. It's important to remember that we're going to have a little bit of speaking history. William Belts grew up in the mining towns of Hancock and Unalakleet. He was a well-known carpenter and president of the Alaskan Council of Carpenters. Belts fought for equal rights for Native Alaskans and Alaska statehood. He represented Unalakleet in the territorial legislature from 1949 to 1959 and the state senate until his passing in 1960. He was the president of the first Alaska State Senate, and he offered an impact on Alaska Governor State still benefits from today. The legislature named a committee room after him, this committee room, in 1979, and rededicated the room after opening the Thomas Stewart Building in 2010. And finally, I wanted to mention that the William E. Belts Party School of Know bears his name. So with that, that's our history moment for this afternoon. I'd like to mention that we are hearing the second hearing for Schedule 98 prescription without the physical exam. The intent is to continue public testimony, which we started last Friday, adopt the committee substitute, and then look to the will of the committee. So now we will start public testimony. The continuation of that, I'd like to invite Dr. Belinda Rathkoff, the president of the Alaska State Medical Association. Thank you for taking time to testify, and we know you have a very busy schedule, and we appreciate you accommodating the committee in order for us to hear your important comments. Thank you. And we're trying to figure out if she's online. Okay, we'll just take a few minutes while we hold on. I'd like to welcome Dr. Belinda Rathkoff, the president of the Alaska State Medical Association. Thank you, Dr. Rathkoff, for making time in your busy schedule for us to hear your comments on Senate Bill 98. And please introduce yourself prior to providing remarks.
Providers do their care to the telemedicine or their patient visits. I'm sure it's the same provider who renders it here. What we're concerned about are models appearing on web with no prior established doctor-patient relationship, innovation that don't get to choose the healthcare provider, and they don't have easy follow-up with the same provider that provided the care. We're concerned about providers who are not smart and that may not understand some of the challenges that our patients here in Alaska face. One of the personal examples that I had pretty early on by ClearUp here was that the patient is Stanford in endocrinology, cardiologist, immunologist, and pediatric. And then the physician contacted me about transferring here and wanted to name the patient to be ready to discharge from the facility. The letter had been delivered to a mirror and the patient was sent there initially. The patient had a rare of the deficiency when the patient actually required ventilator support for the breathing. The provider is being presented in the name of the village near Vera residents and family there, and then it's called after, and she ensured that the family actually had electricity or reliable electricity around the clock, but they didn't have running water, which she had not met. She really had no clue about the village life. If they could understand why the family waited to help her back, and so she did not ask that question directly, they did not answer that. So, you know, I think there are issues that I've learned in 15 years here, and I've never even considered an issue here. This is how it's done that physicians who don't have experience in Alaska or at least experience in other areas that are remote care. You know, there's been testimony before from some of our representatives when we were looking at this issue last year, and it doesn't make sense that here in Alaska should be given by providers licensed in Alaska and residing in Alaska. If we talk to you and are familiar with some of the companies that have very good models, they have very good internal oversight, they have good track records and regulation, the hospitals do that. How can we ensure that if this model happens, that we can ensure the best care for our patients? Well, we want to ensure that the medical model has been fully regulated in medicine. What else is that you need in that way? And we do appreciate that the draft of the bill that was just submitted, I guess you're saying about an hour ago, it keeps the medical board oversight at the individual physician level. But I'm not sure that that would help, but the individual physicians are already licensed and required to be licensed, and their license requires the board oversight. What we would be interested in seeing is oversight more at the company level. What if the telemedicine company as a whole could not meet the standards of care that some that others may deliver, that the safety and flexibility is brought by delivery of care, whether through revoking a business license, whether that's through the medical license or the AG's office or other appropriate department, how can we ensure that not just the individual at the patient level, but the company level as a whole? So this really isn't about self-development or self-development progress. We want to use the progress of the telemedicine capabilities to expand access to lower costs. We just want to ensure it's done well and we have the optimal license. The big thing to consider is that I'm going to stop in the committee for allowing me to have to take the next few teachers.
Our pleasure. Are there any questions for Dr. Rathbaum? Okay, seeing none, thank you again for providing that for testimony to the committee. Next, we have Dr. Philip, or excuse me, Dr. Henry Phillips, with Telegraph calling from National TNC.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My voice is video feed, but I can still hear you just fine, so I apologize. Thank you very, very much to the committee for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I apologize for not being available this past Friday. and I appreciate hearing the previous speaker who I've actually met with in the past. So I just wanted to make a couple points. I'm actually going to begin with the end of the previous presentation and the question that was posed is how do we guarantee that? As clinicians, all of us who are medically trained know that we always look at the data on patient-oriented outcomes, evidence-based data, to make treatment decisions. And so, for example, decades ago, if someone had a heart attack or is a muscle intuitively, it made sense to put that person at bed rest for 2 weeks. And that was the standard of care at the time. Studies have been done, and today the standard of care for heart attack, that very same heart attack is to get the person who's suffering from heart attack up out of bed within the first 24 hours. Why do we do that? Because outcome studies comparing the two treatment modalities have demonstrated that the latter results in much, much better patient outcomes. So the data really determines what we do. not going to be on or frowned upon. My understanding is that the competency is based purely on skills, experience, and training. So let's take a look at the data. First of all, the wellness industry, at least the common complicated medical problems that are handled through wellness and nationwide, is approaching about 2 million e-visits. Our company has been very fortunate. About 1.5 million of those have been done by our company, the rest by other companies in the industry. All the companies in the industry, at least that I've been in contact with, take the clinical care of patients extremely seriously. So one measure could be medical liability claims. And so in private practice, however, you know, I'm happy to share the data support for everything that I'm about to say to the committee. In medical liability world, for every 1,000 patients, excuse me, 1 million patient visits, there are approximately 17 medical liability claims that go through the completion. The average payout is about $248,000 for each of those 17 claims. The primary medical medicine industry is now coming up on 2 million visits. About 1.5 of our industry itself already has up this moment, and not one medical liability claim has been filed. Never mind. Through successful completion for any patient-physician interaction performed through a telemedicine visit in the United States as of the present. So I think that's one reasonable indicator. The second thing I want to talk about is the access and medical cost savings associated with the telemedicine benefit. So a Harvard Medical School researcher independently did some analysis of a 50-state Fortune 50 basically company that operates in every state, including the state of Alaska, 150,000 employees and dependents, and did an 18-month in-post look at the telemedicine benefit that that particular employer decided to implement among its employee base. Pre-post implementation, every single medical consult going through the telemedicine program after 18 months of implementation resulted in an average medical cost savings of $673. If you do the math out to the 575,000 visits that our company conducted in calendar year 2015, we've been able to successfully save all of our clients combined $387 million in medical cost savings. The majority of those are savings in the emergency room for the treatment of non-emergency conditions. So I just wanted to share that data point. The next point I'd like to share is the number of states we operate in. We currently operate in 49 states, including Alaska. The number of lives that we currently cover, we don't know the official number, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 million Americans today, about 5% of the U.S. population. In the state of Alaska, we have clients that include GCI, Alaska Airlines, Home Depot, Lowe's, Premier, not Costco. Also, Aetna is contemplating extending the telemedicine benefit to the state employees, which includes all the legislators. That would be great. And I guess the other thing that I want to share is the importance of the EMR and the clinical quality around the EMR. So we are a sponsored only program. We are already programs are sponsored only, so an employer, health plan, the hospital system has to buy the benefit. It's not direct to consumer, generally speaking, in our world at all. And so it's a sponsor only program. And so the companies that I mentioned, who have chief medical officers, most of all of them, do a lot of due diligence on the companies that administer benefits to their employees. So we've been vetted quite a bit by some very sophisticated folks who seem to think we have a good program and therefore purchase the benefit. Our quality oversight program, I actually wanted to throw a slide up for the group. I could prepare it in time. That basically looks at prescribing patterns across our provider network, and obviously the CDC is very focused on appropriate prescribing as always. There's an interesting outlier that popped up this month on our quality oversight program. And I just thought, you know, private practice, they'll be looking at the prescribing patterns of docs out in the field. And so I wonder how long that would take in the private practice world, in person world, if you will, the non-telemedicine world, for how hard would that to be picked up. We pick up every 30 days. So in any case, I think I'll stop there. And if there are certain questions that you would like to ask, that would be great. I would just leave off with what this bill is focused on is allowing the physicians who are issued an Alaska license, medical license by the Alaska State Medical Board to be able to practice the medicine that they were trained to practice and to decide for themselves what modality they're going to use to diagnose. you very much for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Dr. Phillips. Another question from Claire Kiesel. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, folks, is there a maximum number of times that a person can call for a company before you refer them to a permanent care or stop providing care for them?
Senator Giesel, I apologize that the technology is muted and I'm unmuting my phone, so the beginning part of your question, I apologize.
All right, I'll try again. Maximum number of visits a patient can make through the phone to one of your providers. Do you have a maximum number?
Yes, thank you for asking. So we believe strongly in not interfering with the existing physician-patient relationship. All of our medical materials that go on talk about efficient, your first touch is to call your doctor. Our program is targeted at the 20% of Americans who do not have an existing relationship or folks who are in trial in their business but don't have ready access to their own physician. So we just become another option at that point in our time in physician. And we also send medical records 100% of the time. We give a permission requirement for your death to the primary care physician within one business day of being out so that their physician has the record specific to your question, Senator Giesel. Our platform and with the technology, you can automate a lot of this stuff. If anyone uses us 3 times in 90 days or 8 times in a 12-month period for a super slow diagnosis, they are immediately flagged by the system to the attention of my clinical staff. And immediately reach out to the patient to determine, hey, it looks to me like you're starting to use us as a virtual primary care presence, and we do not want that. You need to have your own in-person primary care presence, and we actually will go so far as to exclude an employee or an insured from our program until they demonstrate back to us that they have established an in-person primary care physician relationship, so we do support that.
Thank you. And, second question, what instructions do you give to the patient in terms of what to do if they don't get better?
Yes, so a couple things. There are discharge instructions after every single encounter, regardless of the nature or outcome of the encounter, including instructions for what to do if things don't improve. If you, well, that's not the wording, but you get the idea. So a couple things. First of all, for a period of 72 hours after every e-visit, and it's included with the crisis register charge, there is a secure email communication back and forth between the patient and our clinical staff, which includes the doctor who did the original e-visit. So for 3 days, there's a mutual rate, so the doctor is able to reach out and say, hey, has your fever gone down? Hey, have you filled the prescription? And the patient can reach back in and say, hey, you know, I've had to worry about the headache, or my fever is actually worse today. So there's that two-way communication capability, which we did design in a couple of years ago, because of clinical quality folks thought it would be good to have that kind of follow-up. So that's number one. So we're available to the patients. Number two is, obviously, we encourage other health plan partners to actually have formal programs in place where we can identify patients who don't have a primary care physician back to the health plan who can then reach out within the following day and say, hey, looks like you used to know that. Looks like you don't have a primary care physician. Let's find you a participating primary care physician in your geographic area. So we have that relationship with our health plan partners, which is always the majority of our business. The majority of our members come to us through health plans. And then the third thing, of course, is both people come to us themselves as well. So, you know, occasionally people will still call us with issues that are not appropriate for the healthcare. It happens 4% of the time. And our physicians are instructed to use the best judgment. And if referral to an in-person setting is the appropriate suggestion, absolutely, we will recommend that happens 4% of the time. We even go so far as to recommend a level, hey, this is a pretty significant problem. You need to call my mom up. Hey, this sounds like you should do okay, but once you give your PCP a call, we have a step in this morning. So you get the idea, we'll recommend a sort of level of follow-up care. Through the platform, some of our clients were able to go in, okay, there's a first education primary care physician, let's say, in your zip code, we can geolocate patients. So with technology, we're starting to do more with that and be much more sort of detailed or more recommendations. We think the last thing to do with this an example, but every state has an example of this. I mean, there are some folks who are just removed from the air, and there is no other option. There's, you know, the business interest, and so on, and so on, and of the data that makes this. I want to say there's like 29 counties that have no doctors or one doctor. And these are the two areas that just don't have options. And so sometimes the government option is the best and sometimes the only option. You know, that's not the case, but it's better than what it is without the normal medicine benefit, if you will.
Next, Dr. David Powers, calling in from
Longham. Hello, this is David Powers. And can you hear me?
Yes, you can hear me, please.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to give you a call and just listen on the last community on this same bill. And I just wanted to say that the current method that we use for telemedicine is only all comers, it's not really segregated to Latin natives, so there are proportionally a lot more Latin natives in rural Alaska than rural non-natives. But, you know, that's for all comers. It always has been. You don't deny anyone health care. There's no way in town, you know, not all comers can come. So, because I just wanted to point out was that I think there may be a misperception of what rural Alaska is like. That is, there's no pharmacy. It is there, close to the Great Lock. And when you make telemedicine available, and as a result, a lot of people will not be able to do medicine in their prescribed, other than just going to the village health aid, which is kind of their back of the old system. Those, of course, who are going to have to bail out from Anchorage or in another block as well, it would be a pharmacy. I think this will probably mostly impact Alaska that live in larger cities where there are pharmacies available. And if I was in high marks for convenience, I think it would probably save money relative to a doctor visit in person or an emergency room visit. But I don't think it's going to ever the standard of an incursion visit as far as just getting good medicine. The last thing I'd like to say is that I have no financial irons in this fire. I get paid 20 hours a week, not over 40 or 80. And I've just finished my second term on the board. I'm speaking to the board of life, and that was really a financial motivation behind what we said about this bill. So, but if
thank you very much, Dr. Powers. Appreciate your attention to this bill. For the committee members, I do want to mention that in the room we have the Corporation Consumer Professional Licensing Director, Jimmy Covington. If you have questions, we have Sarah Chambers, who's also available for questions. Margaret Rowley with Healthcare Services, available for questions, and Dr. Melissa Ring, who is with the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. If there are any questions for any of those individuals? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone who in general would like to testify on Consent Bill 98? Please come forward. Please, thank you.
My name is Bill Otlin, and I'm a registered pharmacist in rural, remote Alaska. I'm also on the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. And I didn't know about this bill before I came to Jimmo, but I just feel like I worked in rural Alaska. I worked with Dr. Powers and Diane and the Bethel, and we're of the native health system, but my wife and I started a pharmacy in Craig, Alaska, which is probably the most remote pharmacy in Alaska, as far as a licensed pharmacy. But I just wanted to, without knowing any background in previous comments, having served 8 years ago on the Board of Pharmacy and recently back on the Board of Pharmacy, I just wanted to bring up the idea of rural remote providers and the election medical board licenses for doctors is important, but the medical board just passed a grant, I believe it went through legal, that many of the providers that are public health service in rural remote Alaska can't be licensed if they were created health corporations. And I believe that's going to come down the pipe for pharmacy for dental nursing. And so I was a little bit confused of how this pertained to a lot of the providers that are going to be served by in rural areas that are going to be served under many health corporations that won't even be able to have a license. And I'm going to sort that out. Because the Board of Pharmacy is looking at trying to do the same thing with the medical court picking up. You understand what I'm talking about? That the Attorney General came out with an opinion that the Board of Pharmacy asked for 10 or 12 years ago about should providers be licensed or pharmacists, particularly. The interpretation is that the medical providers, it looks like, that aren't public health service uniform officers will not have to be licensed when they're working for any health corporations. So I don't know how that's going to affect this bill, but I just felt like I should mention that because I was on the Board of Pharmacy when we were dealing with the Attorney General. We waited 10 years before we got a response, and the response was tied to the confusing an interpretation of the Affordable Care Act. So, again, I just wanted to mention that. Who is licensed? What board is over what providers in rural areas? Because to me, we passed on a pharmacy race for the Board of Pharmacy. But if you're not licensed because of who you work for, and Dr. Powers mentioned that a lot of patients aren't maybe beneficiaries. The Board of Pharmacy is over the health and welfare of all the citizens. If Native Health is exempted, the Attorney General's opinion is that rural telemedicine serve non-Native Zone also exempted from licensed in-state providers.
Thank you very much for your questions and comments. I'm looking online to see if there's somebody who is available to answer that question. Is that yes. Ms. Hannigan, are you able to come forward and respond to the questions that we just posed? Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair. And committee members, my name is Jamie Hannigan. I'm the Commissioner of the Corporation Assistance and Professional Licensing. I believe what he is referring to is the federal law that that exempts medical professionals either working for tribal corporations or for the federal government. And my understanding on top of that law, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Hannigan, it is true that IHS employees have federal rights and they don't have to be licensed in the state of practicing unless it's in a state, right? So, it could be Alabama or Florida or whatever. But this is kind of a pronounced bit of existence for what I've seen for around 20 years. So this is new that Native corporations would be compensated like, because you could be I worked for the Tribal Health Consortium. I was not exempted from being licensed and stabilized. So it'd be interesting to clarify that. I think it's very important.
To the chair, thank you very much. We will do that and provide you with some follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Hannigan. Is there anybody else online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 98? Is anyone in June who would like to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 98, and I wanted to make sure that we have a draft from next April, and we will recess the committee until 2:30 to give our staff time to just review it was presented to the committee. So with that, we are recessed. Our labor and commerce committee back in order. The time is 2:37, and we have a committee folks to the floor. Senator Kiesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the CS for Senate Bill 98, Version 29, LS 0838 ECHO, as a working document before the committee.
I'll go ahead and object for the sake of discussion and invite my lady whatsoever to explain the changes, and then you can ask questions.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Ellis, after the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'll walk through the changes in the committee substituting in backslash E for Senate Labor and Commerce. I'm going to speak to some of the substance and work my way into it. Members also will be retract changes beginning on page 2. It begins on line 16, continuing to the start of section 3. These are primarily sort of standards of care. Other draft interventions. Line 20, section 3, as the duties of the board, which include text provided by some of the stakeholders, specifically, Madam Chair, beginning on page 3. That's subsection 6. The text reading adopt regulations establishing standards of care for a physician who is rendering a diagnosis, providing treatment, or prescribing, dispensing, or administering a prescription drug to a person without conducting a physical examination under AS 086-4364, the regulations listed to the nationally recognized model policy for standards of care of a patient with a different location than the physician. Line 9 is a renumbering. That is also the case for line 29 on page 3. Continuing Madam Chair to page 4, line 5, subsection D. Now the standard E and C of this section, a physician may not prescribe abortion inducing drugs, a basic approval for fashion to prescribe or dispense or administer a prescription drug as a controlled substance in response to an internet questionnaire, electronic mail message, or audio telephone consultation if the physician does not have a prior physician-patient relationship. Madam Chair, these changes were arrived at in consultation with the stakeholders to provide a little bit of safeguards with regards to the duty of telemedicine. Relating to some of the comments from members, we have originally looked at the committee substitute rephrasing the regulatory language in each section from prohibitions to positives. In consultation with legislative legal, we decided against that. And advice of counsel, basically what it came down to was it's preferable to have limits with regards to the board may not, as opposed to explicit things that the board may do. They cited several court examples where if we try to encapsulate everything that the board is authorized to do explicitly, that can mean courts can infer that the legislation only explicitly authorizes these things. Thus, at the advice of legislation, we look at these as phrasing at the beginning of each section, the board may not impose, as opposed to proactively authorizing. Again, that was done primarily at the advice of legislative legal. And I'm sure members will also have in their packets memorandum that we received from the Department of Commerce today answering senators' questions with regards to the financial impact of various health boards. So that will be in March 1st. The administration also providing a memo that the last gentleman who participated in public testimony referenced. This is a State Department of Law to the Board of Pharmacy dated April 17th, 2012. And this is brought up not in a statement of administrative policy, but just to answer any context to the previous testifiers' positions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That includes the changes in the CS. And I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the committee substitute. Is there further objection to the committee substitute?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a conceptual amendment to offer. So if members add, I'm starting on page 4. of those schools so folks can follow along. And I'm addressing lines 7 through 10. It's number 2. And the amendment would cause these lines to read, prescribe, dispense, or administer a prescription drug. Then remove the words, that is a controlled substance. So those 5 words would be removed. The sentence would then continue in response to an internet questionnaire, and here the word or would be inserted. The sentence would go on electronic mail message, and then remove the words, there are 5 words to remove, or audio-only telephone consultation. And then the sentence would complete with whom the physician does not have a prior physician-patient relationship. So in total, that we now read, directed, prescribe, dispense, or administer a prescription drug in response to an internet questionnaire or electronic mail message with whom the physician does not have a prior physician-patient relationship. So I move this conceptual amendment on to.
Is there any objection you would like to the amendment? I see none, so move the amendment and amended version of the 2062. And before I say analysis, is there further objection now to the 2062 as amended? Yes, anyone else?
I'd like yourself to reference the Alaska State Medical Association letter to identify the 4 or 5 concerns expressed by the association. I'm wondering if Mr. Hatter could reference those concerns and whether the committee substitute has proposed addresses those concerns, and if so, how on your bike stand.
Absolutely.
And that would determine if I maintain further objection to the adoption of the committee substitute.
Absolutely.
Certainly, for the record, again, I'm sharing this with all the staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Through the chair, Senator Ellis, the committee worked closely with ASRS representatives from the Capitol and the sponsor in implementing provisions of the letter dated February 25th, 2016. Most of those, I just go right through if you'd like, Senator. We also have a representative from ASMO and a sponsor through the room. Most of it was, again, providing for kind of the safeguards and signboards that were previously. Let's say I'll look at page 1 of their letter. Prescription not being a controlled substance. Physician be located in Alaska. Physician or another physician in group practice available to provide follow up care. And the patient consent to send a copy of records to the patient's primary care provider. I'll be working with the sponsor to retain this.
Senator Ellis, would you like the sponsor to come forward?
Well, I just want to answer the question of whether all of the concerns of this Alaska State Medical Association are fully addressed in the proposed committee substitute. That's the simple answer that I'm looking for.
And through the chairman, Senator Olson, I might read the letter. It kind of takes a two-step approach in outlining both ASMA's concerns, but also providing for that if the committee sees fit to move forward with the bill providing provisions for amendments and suggestions. So I guess there's kind of two tracks that are suggested in the association's letter. I think, and really specifically through it, we can have the sponsor as we speak to it. I think one of the key of the provisions that we would like to see amended in advance of moving forward with the session.
Senator Diesel. Madam Chair, you know, as I look at this new working draft that we're working on, I see the change that occurs again on page 2. It's actually all of section 3. And it's the big change is adding number 6 on page 3. And I'll tell you that this is the powers of the board. The duties of the board. So it's the board shall, this is the statement of the board, shall adopt regulations establishing standards of care for a physician who is rendering diagnosis, providing treatment, or prescribing diagnosis, and administering a prescription drug to a person by conducting a physical exam. Now, this kind of language, and I recognize, it's a recognized model policy for standards of care. I am not positively located. I suspect that that warning comes from the model policy from the National State Medical Board organization. And so I think this probably provides the board itself with the latitude to be pretty specific about telehealth services.
Thank you. I think that I would feel better if we had somebody from the United States Medical Association just answer some of Alice's questions. So I think I'll just take a brief and easily look into it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I was making a question of whether this proposed can be a substitute and currently before the committee addresses the concerns to what extent adequately or what extent the five concerns of the State Medical Association in our listed in your letter of concern. So could you address that for us, please?
Yes, so we do feel comfortable that this could be substituted for the community services and we can create by working with the issues still that even during the current creating that registry for businesses that can have been well tested and have some oversight more at a basis level. But generally, the concepts that are in the next step to be substituted, I think we agree with. And so we're investing in these, but still going. And I'm so capable of having the individual decision level that the licensee board already has, that the ability at business level to regulate, to create a different model of all the benefits of what the company runs, level business, and there's a part of business oversight.
Thank you, Dr. Rathcock. And do you feel that the provisions in the federal allowing the board to have regulations, do you have authority or is that something that you would like to see added?
I think that's something that needs to be added. Additionally, I have that authority at the business level. Like I said, you know, we've come from certain telemedicine companies. They have a very good working model. They have good data. They have good customers. They have good policies. But those systems are not open to allow these businesses to come in. How do we make sure that future companies or businesses adopt to that same standard? And what would be the oversight? Because there's an oversight at an individual position level that the position is something that might give their license to license to be revoked. And that would include whether they're practicing it at the telemedicine or in person. That's the difference in what I do. But is there oversight more at business level where the state can say, we don't think this is a good business model. We don't think this company is doing the business of caring for my patients in our state. And what would be the ability to regulate that?
Is there objections to any things in the house?
Yes.
Okay. I would like to invite Jamie Fortenhead with the Corporations Business and Professional Licensing to come forward.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the program. So I would just say that I appreciate the work that's been done to address four of the five concerns, but it seems like Labor and Commerce is the place to work together to address the concern about the business oversight issue.
no public hearing needed. I had the intent of the chair to deliver the best work product to the next committee as possible. So I am with you on this, and I'd like to have Ms. Huffington, based on what you've heard, do you feel that there's language that you can suggest? I'm still looking at page 3, perhaps. After line 8, section 7 allows the board to adopt regulations that would provide for appropriate business oversight. And if you'd like me to take that as when you talk to the Senator, you feel? Madam Chair, I appreciate what the State Medical Association is proposing, but I don't believe by authority belongs to the State Medical Board. I believe it belongs to the division of business group alternatives, division, not a specific board of medicine.
Ms. Huffington, would you like to comment on that question?
Thank you for that. My name is Jane Huffington. There's an order for personal business and professional licensing. I believe that this can be completely fleshed out in regulations. I think it is either, but I believe it would be under the board jurisdiction. I would need to complete further research that. I know that the fees are in the cost, but I'm not sure of that. And I don't know if Senator Chambers is still on the line, but I think she could probably clarify a little bit better.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Are you all right and listening to the discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm
for us, we It is now 3 o'clock, and so we will hold this bill. We will work on a committee sponsorship and return it to the committee to look at.